So the phone is picking up sound.
But if I mute the phone and I turn on the mic, it still does it.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
That's so weird.
Excuse us, muting the phone.
So do we all need to hop on with our own phones so we can...
Do you want... And that phone does looks like it really can't move because the cord's too short.
It will be a little bit.
I don't think it does.
Not that that helps a ton, but...
No.
I do one phone.
Just a little.
So we have a mic. Just have the room.
The what?
We might do
Glenn, can you hear that?
Mine's almost dead, but... Just put it on
Mine's
there
good.
And join the meeting with that, and then we'll have a microphone through one of the phones.
Oh, that's true. Oh, okay.
Just one concern.
Yes.
The three counselors present, so if you could let them know someone has to leave.
One has to leave.
Yeah, that's a quorum for them.
That's a nice phone. Is that even a case for a meeting that is the advisory board? This is a publicly posted meeting, though.
Yes, it is.
So I don't know if that applies, because we've had all the counselors here.
It's not publicly posted. It's not posted in the public.
I don't think that applies, though.
It's posted online. It is public.
Yeah, we can't have three counselors.
Yeah.
I see your
chance. What are appropriate meetings? What are meetings that are appropriate that three counselors can attend?
Are the council meetings?
That's council meetings. Can you do workshops?
Just these guys?
No. Yeah, workshops.
Workshops are posted.
Workshops are posted?
Right, work sessions are posted.
Okay.
Yep. I don't have a log
in. And then we have to show up.
I think we get logged in on this too.
Got it.
Wait.
It's in the agenda. On the agenda.
It might have been, actually. Let me
get your email.
No, it's from last week's. I had it on last week's.
Do you want to text Jeff by chance? We, Riston?
Open it up.
I can text him.
Yeah.
That's okay.
Well, that's, I have him under Mr. Jeffrey P. Riston.
We had a pretty full agenda.
Councillor Belcott just left, so I think we're okay.
Welcome, and thanks for coming.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here. That's these aren't working. It's just recording.
Just recording. We don't have mics, so they won't hear us.
Even if we, so everything is echoing.
Yeah.
And all the mics are in there.
And if you change it over, you're gonna pick up their stuff because we're gonna try to change it in.
What if I?
You could try.
Do we have presentations on that side?
Yeah. Jose.
But that's okay. This is to catch everything.
Okay.
If we speak. Maybe.
So you got a microphone on there. We just have to really speak up.
Let's see.
I'm in the lobby. Maybe. Maybe I'm not.
Could Jamie join by phone, maybe? Or is he one of the four?
He is there. He's on.
Oh, he's on?
Yeah, Jamie's on.
Okay, I've got mine.
Is Jamie one of the four not yet appointed, though?
Okay.
This is fun.
Yeah, we need
so
Jeff.
We need Jeff.
Yeah.
Okay. I texted Jeff, but I have not heard back yet.
So I don't know if you can hear us online. Oh, they can now. Oh, we're getting echoed.
It's a delay.
Is that because you have that?
Yes.
Okay, so if I turn this on, that might be an issue.
Yeah, so he can, so maybe hit mute.
Okay, it's going to mute.
Or you can ask them if they can hear me and see if
they're... Is yours on right now?
No.
So take yours off of mute.
Okay.
Can you hear me? Diana Nutt, can you hear me?
Diana, can you hear April?
She might not be on.
She's on, because I was down there.
Barely. Okay, let me try it. So go ahead and mute.
If you turn your...
Seth, is there anybody else besides Jeff that isn't here that could cover?
No, because there's five positions that expired.
But then we don't have as much for a quorum then.
Where's our
We have to just do whatever is 50% of the active. So the ones that expired, we don't have to count them. So if we have eight people,
that's
four
true.
Now.
So there'd be six now.
So we have three people. Yeah. So who's still on? I'm still on.
Yeah. I'm on.
So yeah, we have enough that are on of the active members right now.
Yeah. Right.
So,
Diana,
I think we're good. Yeah, we have a quorum.
So then, Seth, if we have any active votes...
It sounds to me like there's a lot of overlapping on the voices. And I think everyone's going to have to talk and then stop for the next person to talk again.
Okay. So if we have anything that we vote on, we'll just need to make sure it's specific quorum to those that are still active.
Yeah.
Okay. We will consider the non-members advisory votes.
This meeting is being recorded.
So they can still say what they how they would vote, but it doesn't count.
It's an advisor.
They have to be appointed by the commissioner.
So the
city manager.
City manager.
No. Are we just using your mic? Okay, so you can get off.
We'll just have to be careful. One person speaking at a time.
Okay. All right. Well, welcome to the April Development and Engineering Advisory Board. With that, I'll start out with introductions. I am Seth Pauling with AKS Engineering.
Andrew Gunther with BLS Engineering.
April 1st,
Director
of Community Development.
Fletcher, Community Development.
Nicole Pizer,
Community Development.
Brad Davis, Land Use,
Terry Wallum, Wallum & Associates.
Mike Odrin, Olson Engineering, a division of McKay Sposito.
Eric Galimo, SGA Engineering.
Dan Weisner, Songbird Homes.
Ryan Wilson, Wilson Architects.
Max Booth, Community Development.
Sue Marshall, Council District 5.
Houston Auto, Auto Construction.
And those online.
Susan Ellinger, Community Planning.
With that, just a reminder that this DEEB meeting is being recorded and the audio will be posted to DEEB's website. The first item on here is review and adoption of the meeting minutes from March.
Move to adopt. Or
second. Motion and a second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Motion carries. Review of upcoming events. Megan, if you could cover those items, please.
I think the biggest event on the table right now is the reappointment, reseating of the four members of DEEB, Seth, Mike, Andrew. So I have been working with Michelle Benning with the counselor's office, and at this time, Mike has a at-large position, so Deeb needs to recommend that Mike can be reseated, or Mike is wanting to be reseated.
I make that motion to reseat Mike.
Second.
I second. I agree.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Thank you. I will put that in the letter, and then we do have an open seat for a public planner, engineer, that will be going out to the press as well for the last seat.
Who filled that seat previously?
Nick.
Nick Flagg.
Nick Flagg.
Oh, public.
PUD.
Yep. Sorry. PUD.
Yep, that's right.
It'd be great to get someone from City of Vancouver. We've said it before, but, you know, with all the stuff we work on, we work so closely, we should maybe reach out to someone from the city.
It was nice to have Clark Regional with Steve Bacon. That was really helpful. I think Seth had reached out and made an ask of... Less, thank you.
And okay. Keith Henderson is there too, right?
Right, but we thought with Les's role in the development side of it that he would be, I guess, maybe better option if it worked for him to join. So, but yeah.
But we could put it out to either. Both, though. I think Seth made a good point. Jason's pretty busy because the other thought was Jason Oster.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
But
sure.
I know Jason gets a lot of... He has a lot of work, and he gets a lot of things done, and his schedule is pretty demanding, so it might be better with Les or Heath, if one of those two would be willing.
Yeah.
But I think it would be very helpful to have one of them. I know Seth had reached out. I've never communicated with Heath before, but I have with Les. I could follow up with Les as well. I know Les is going to be gone for the next 3 weeks or 2 weeks. So I don't know if anyone knows Heath that would want to reach out to Heath.
I don't know Heath. I only know Jason.
Oh, sure.
I know him a little bit, but I would agree that Les might be a better candidate just in terms of his work with
community graphics. Totally agree.
They can hear what we're saying, but they need us to be louder.
User or tech voice.
Use your mic voice.
Use your power
voice. Exactly like mic, please.
Yeah. Okay.
This is not our typical meeting style. No. Just apologize to the guy, to everybody online, and we will try to do our best to speak up.
So do we have someone who can reach out to Les?
Seth already did.
Well, did you get a response?
I just sent the email when the opening was posted, and I didn't receive a response. So,
anyone else want to offer to reach out to Les?
I don't know him that well at this point. I could do that, but I haven't worked with him.
I'm waiting for a response from him on a project, so I could follow up once he responds.
Yeah. Good.
Thank you, Terry.
Yeah.
That's really all I have. The work plan, we are going to discuss it. It is on the agenda, so it is being discussed, but that is something that would be an event. I will not be at that meeting. So just heads up on that. That's all I have.
What is the work plan scheduled for?
It's scheduled for April 26th during the counselor work session.
Brent, would you be able to attend that meeting with the council on the 26th as the previous staff liaison for Deeb?
No.
No?
He's at a land use training.
Oh, all right. Oh, we can always follow up with that. We can do the meeting ourselves if we need to. Okay.
As far as other items for upcoming meetings on that, is it the second page?
Oh, my apologies. Planning Commission is having a work session on April 20th at 6:30 for CPZ 2022-15 and 16, amendment procedures for countywide planning, and an amendment, it looks like, to ordinance CCC 40-510.040.
And did I see on the council agenda that there's also a council hearing on the 16th at 6 p.m. for the 20-year population projection?
Correct.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's a public hearing, and then I believe there's a work session on the 19th at 9 a.m. for the capital plan updates. With that, is there any member announcements?
The only, the growth projection is something that Dee may want to weigh into, and that is happening very quickly. So there was a work session. We didn't really have time to even get it on our agenda, but it is a fairly significant item affecting the comp plan, which we're following pretty closely as a board. So I don't know how we could fit that on our agenda this time, but it's next week.
We've discussed it in the past, but I don't think we've had any say in what direction they would suggest, in so only to say that the past projections have been too low.
And once again, we've averaged close to 2% growth over the last 10 years, and they're recommending the middle range, I think it's 1.2, which... Right. If we fail to plan, we're going to have a lot of problems in our community. We're going to have less affordability because we already have a supply issue. And if we go with a too low of a rate, what it does is we end up not planning for the future. We don't have the infrastructure. We haven't planned. The risk of going too high is that we overplan, but we don't have to build it. So updating a capital facilities plan and having a plan in place, I think, is a much better option than not planning at all and then having to react and being behind the ball. So historically, I'm not sure, OFM, in the last plan, they used an average of the last 7 years. That's how they calculated it, the last plan. And that turned out to be 1.12% because it was the recession years. This time, they changed the metric, and they're not doing it the same way. They're not doing it an average of those years. They kind of just pulled their best guess, I guess, based on other factors. So they changed the metrics. They're looking a little bit historical. But we've really never seen a growth rate even close to 1.2 except for the recession years, which was kind of an outlier. So it is significant, and if it gets adopted even in the middle range, I think it's going to be really low, and it's not going to adequately keep up with what we're really seeing in Clark County. Yeah. And we're going to create problems in our community.
Are there other organizations that are providing alternate analyses?
There is. Yeah, it's a pretty tight timeline. So.
Where we've really chimed in during these times is as far as the infrastructure percentage, the deduction for public infrastructure. Have they established that yet? Does anybody here know? Oliver, if you're on, have they established the infrastructure percentage?
Yes, they did that with the vacant buildable lands model. That was in that model.
Okay, and do we know what that percentage ended up being?
They changed the metric so it no longer matters. They just went with achieved density. So it doesn't even factor in anymore.
Oh, that's right.
Remember,
we had that discussion a year and a half ago or so.
Yep.
Yep, okay.
But just, so back to the growth rate, I think we can maybe make a quick motion based on something that's here. So last time when they updated the plan in 2015, the growth rate that they adopted was 1.12%. The actual rate in that time period was much higher at 2.03. So it was off significantly last time. Let's see. And then In the last update, they forecasted the growth rate from the years 2007 to 2013, which included the recession years. They've changed the metrics with this update. If they use the same metrics as this time, if they use the same way of calculating it this time, the average growth rate from the last 7 years would be 2.03%. If we use the last 10 years, it would be 1.88%. The last 20 years, it's 1.8%. And it's averaged 1.89, and there's a lot of numbers here, but there's a pattern that basically says what we've been growing at in the last 20 years plus is closer to 1.9 to 2% in that kind of range, between 1.8 and 2.1%. So the metrics that they came out with this time, the high, middle, and low rate, and let me just pull this up real quick, I do have it here.
And Oliver's not on, but Jackie is Oliver today.
Okay.
Oliver.
So the low rate from OFM was 0.6% growth. The middle was 1.26, and the high is 1.51. My guess, and actually Jamie and I talked about it last time, we actually made a guess on the growth rate, which we had pretty close. It was, we were like 1.8 to 2, which is exactly what we saw in that time period. I'm guessing in the next year we are going to see it slowing a little bit, just based on demographics, on interest rates. I would like 1.7 to 1.8 is probably more realistic. It's going to go down from what we've seen in the last few years, based on other factors, and the just the demographics of the baby boomers and the births versus deaths. So it is going to go down a little bit.
But the demographics are coming. I mean, there's another wave of growth coming for the demographics. It should start about 2024, another 4 years, level off a little bit. And then at the end of the 2030s, it greatly increase again. So,
one thing that's unique to our community that OFM really didn't put in here to the same level is the in-migration from across the river. And because of the Portland metro area's failure to plan and failure to provide housing, it's coming over here.
Right.
So we end up getting a little more growth than they expect from in-migration, different than other parts of the state, and they just kind of used, I think, an average. They didn't really calculate it based on what we're actually seeing here. We're not looking at historical. So if we look at historical, it would be higher.
Jamie Housing did have his hand up for a minute.
Oh, okay.
Jamie?
Are the speakers turned on here in the room?
Just a moment, Jamie. We can't hear you. Hold on.
We can hear you now.
Sorry about that. What I was going to say is I agree with Eric that, you know, last time he and I fought vehemently against what OFM had suggested because Clark County clearly follows a very historical pattern of percentage growth that's closer to 2%, and basing it on sort of anomaly years seems a little bit incorrect. And during the work session last week, Long Range had a graph up there that showed post-recession the growth rate climbing back above the 2%. And then there was a little bit of a dip, which appears to be primarily related to COVID. But I would suspect that rate is going to, you know, go back up again and continue to be, you know, closer to 2% over the life of the next plan. And I completely agree with Eric that the downside of not planning for it is we're just going to keep digging ourselves into a larger and larger hole with affordability for both job land and housing. Whereas if we went the other way, the risk is that we have oversized capital facility plans, but we all know how that goes anyway. Like the cities have to annex that and prepare plans to do that for the Wonder Garden, and the county sticks a bunch of land in urban holding until that gets factored out. I'm not seeing much downside to being more aggressive in there.
So just keep an eye when the mic is. Oh, you can't see my screen.
Yeah.
I have to unmute us every time they speak so we don't get feedback. So give me a second to do that
okay.
when we go back and forth. But now it's us.
Got it. Okay. I guess we have a full agenda. I don't want to take up too much more time. We've looked at this in the past. It's something we have covered. But I would, I guess, make a motion that we recommend adopting something towards the historical population growth we've seen in Clark County towards the upper end of the OFM range, which I think is still below what we're going to see. I'm guessing we're going to see 1.7 to 1.8 over the next 20 years. And we're going to plan for, even on the higher end of the range, we're going to underplan. And we're going to be playing catch up. And there's a lot of adverse impacts on our community. And it's not, it's, you know, it's affordability. We're already in a housing crisis. We're already in an affordability issue. We have all these other things we're looking at to try to make housing more obtainable and affordable. Supply is the biggest issue, really. The most fundamental economic principle is supply and demand. If we don't have the supply, the existing homes don't even, they don't become affordable. And we're pricing people out of our community, and it ends up being just a bad cycle that we're getting in. So I guess the motion would be that we adapt towards the higher end of the range in line with historical growth that we've seen in Clark County over the last 20 years.
So there's a motion.
Yeah, I think, I guess on the wording, just make sure it clearly what's, I would say that we would recommend the high range OFM projection for growth, which is under our historical growth rate. Does that sound fine?
Yeah, we could mention, and it's in the materials. We have that here. But over the last 10 years, we have grown by 1.88%. If you want to put that in the motion, that is our growth rate for the last 10 years is 1.88%. And we would look to get closer in line with that. And the choices we have, because of the way the RCW is written, we have to go between 0.6 and 1.51. We could recommend an exact number, but they're still below.
Does the RCW, does the language in the RCW mean that we cannot, that it cannot be adopted higher than what OFM has indicated?
As I understand, yes.
Okay.
So we have a range of what we can pick in this county of 0.6 to 1.51. And what I would say is we should recommend looking at the higher range to be in line with historical growth in Clark County over the last 20 years and beyond.
Does that work for you, Terry?
Yeah, I just like breaking it up to say specifics of, I think it's great to be able to say what the last 10-year average was, what that rate was, and then to specifically say what the high-range OFM percentage is, because I believe when I was seeing numbers, it was just giving total population growth and not percentage of growth, which makes it a little bit hard. For me, I'm not able, it's easier for me to track if we say percentages and if we say total population numbers. You know, I'm not smart enough to do math in my head to figure that out. So
we could add that in, that we want it to be closer to the historical average growth rate of 1.8%. So the last 10 years, we had 1.88. When you go back 20 years, you capture the Great Recession, it brings it down a little bit,
yep.
And that brings it to 1.8. But it is a cycle, and probably the more data we use, the better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it does, just by the basics of numbers, because it's always a percentage, by nature, because we're dealing with a larger number to begin with, the same number of people is a smaller percentage. So you should get a regression in the percentage over time, mathematically. We just wanted to make sure that we're as accurate as possible and we're planning for growth so we don't get surprised. So, and that can be captured in the conversation if you want to go back and listen to our discussion. But I would say, again, kind of trying to reiterate the motion that we recommend they adopt the higher end of the range, which is closer to our historical growth rate in Clark County over the last 20 years of 1.8%.
I second
Great.
That.
Okay. All right. Motion and second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thanks. Try to keep that clear.
Do you have anyone voting online? Because we wouldn't be able to
Jamie,
hear them.
Yeah, we wouldn't be able to count.
So they'd have to put their hands up.
Well, we couldn't count Jamie at this point.
Okay.
This is my understanding.
Jamie said aye. Okay.
Okay. Advisory, aye. Okay.
So that would be advisory, but I can vote, since you guys have... Robert, back off.
Okay, good.
Any other member announcements? We did receive an email regarding concern over when staff takes like an extended vacation and not always having someone who can fill in for that position. I think in the case that was brought up, it was final plats are delayed, you know, and there's a couple that are in process and, you know, it's a delay of a week and a half or something where when you're at that stage in a development project, it can have pretty big impact financially. So I don't know if there's a solution to that which the county can consider, but just wanted to bring that to the group's attention.
From the private sector side, whenever we're going on vacation, we let our clients know. If there's anything pressing, we get it done ahead of time, and we put in the extra time that's necessary to go on vacation. So sometimes we don't really get a vacation because we put in 2 weeks the week before we go, then we have the week off, then we have to pick up and make up for the next week for the week that we were off. So that might just need to be something that staff would need to do, or at least at a minimum take a look at what is the most critical, the ones that are their timelines are coming up or something along those lines. Or like we do in the private sector, do a little bit of work on your vacation.
Or is it an opportunity where we can staff can designate a replacement to fill in? I know some cases you're limited.
Well, that's what I was going to say. So final plats used to only be able to be signed by the county engineer. That signing authority has been given to Jennifer, so now I have two people in the county that can do it.
Okay, that's awesome.
And the reason that we put Jennifer as a signing authority is because we went for a while without a county engineer, and that same thing was happening. So I feel pretty good about it. If there's a pressing one, I have Ken later.
Okay, great.
Those have to coordinate their vacations.
Yeah. With that, the next item on the agenda is our accomplishments and work plan. We discussed this previously, and I'm not sure if Jamie has had a chance to complete the portion with the accomplishments.
Was that not completed? Did we not review that at our last meeting? I don't have my last meeting notes with this.
Yeah, we reviewed it a draft form.
Okay.
So I guess there just hasn't been a final version, which I believe it needs to be provided to council a week before our work session with them. Is that correct? So next week we need to provide it.
I mean, we've got 30 minutes allotted for this. I don't see why we're going to need 30 minutes.
Well, we're behind schedule, so we're at the time frame for the next agenda item.
Well, do we need to review it any further after Jamie gets the accomplishments in?
I guess we can send around an email.
Let's
final
do that.
Draft for,
okay. Yeah.
You said I would send my notes on Monday.
Perfect.
Okay.
Let's thank you, Jamie. Then.
All right, moving to the next item regarding public notice biennials and the update there. April, if you could.
Yep. So I have, so we're starting the biennial process again, and we had our first meeting about the next one. So I do need, if Deeb has suggestions, I am going to need those in the next 30 days. So if you have things that you want on biennials, for us to consider, we will need those in the next 30 days because we are starting that process now. One of the items that's going to be on there is noticing, and it is what the proposal that will probably be on there right now is 500 for urban, 1,000 for rural, and at least 20 residences noticed, with a minimum of 20 residences noticed. So that can change throughout the process, which is the point of the process, but that's how we're going to put it on there originally.
So that's interesting that you have a minimum of neighbors notified, because if you are in a rural project, and I think we've discussed a little bit that it makes sense to have a wider radius as far as notification, but if you're now then suddenly having to find neighbors or find people to notify when they're probably, when they're so far out of range that there wouldn't be any impact to them anyway, is that really worth the effort?
Well, I would say this is what if, right, because when you get to a rural area, you could have one property owner own 10 parcels. So could that one property owner then count as 10? Because I can think of next to a development that I had, there was one property owner that owned 6 parcels, which encapsulated close to 180 acres. So obviously they would have strong input based off of that exposure that they had to the impact you're going to make to that site. So I don't know if that would help to fill that 20-person quota. If it did, that I could wrap my head around that. That would make sense to me.
So instead of having households, it'd be parcels?
Yeah, ownership of parcels, right? Because whether you live there or own it, it's the same. It's a different impact than if you live there, but it is impacting your ownership of that property and in your current use and your desirable future use. So it would seem appropriate to me as whether it's a homeowner or a property owner, it would be the same, and it would be parcel, a minimum of 20 parcels. I don't know if that works.
Where did you come up?
I think that was King County.
King County. So.
Yes, but also I brought it in front of council, and it will still have to go to council and planning commission.
Sure, sure, sure.
Council and planning commission. But that is how it will be written, and then we can discuss it as it goes through that.
One of the counties that I think we've always been kind of compared to is Snohomish County. What kind of notification do they have with
Snohomish there? Is interesting, and I happen to have it up, I think. I do. Okay. Snohomish is 500 feet of any portion of the boundary of the subject property and continuous property owners by the applicant. 1,000 feet if the subject property is categorized as rural, natural resource, residential 20,000, R20,000 or rural use,
mm-hmm.
and then 1,500 feet for subdivision applications where the lot is where it affects 20 acres or larger. They have the strictest.
That's Snohomish, you said?
That's Snohomish.
Okay. That's Snohomish.
Is there a state guidance at all?
State guidance is 3 and 5. That's what
3
we
and 5.
Use.
Three so and that's five. What we use. 305. Is there any state guidance on households?
No.
And this is just a public notice that's going out on this. This is going to be the biannuals that we're going to have another chance to weigh in on.
Four chances.
So this is something I think we can think about. They're just going to public notice it either way. It's a good heads up and appreciate it, but I don't know that we need to spend that much time on it.
I don't think so.
It's always hard to argue against making sure the public is notified.
Yes.
And we want to make sure the public's
totally
adequately notified.
Right.
So we want to make sure that but we also want to make sure that we don't have bad definitions or something that's hard to achieve or you can't even do through a title company that makes it, you know, cost prohibitive or just impossible to do. And we've ran into that before with good intention code language where we use a wrong definition or we try to invent something on our own and there's unintended consequences.
Right.
So we want to make sure that we make sure when we do review it that we make sure that the public is notified as much as they need to be and it really makes sense.
RGIS will provide that information too.
I just want to say, Jamie said, what problem are we trying to solve with the minimum number of residences?
A larger notice radius. The public coming to public hearings saying that they were not noticed on projects that directly affected them.
Yeah.
Can I use this time to talk about one other thing? Okay. We did a land use hearing with for the Washougal Pit, and the
for the what?
Washougal Pit.
Yep.
Okay.
And the hearings examiner implemented time limits: 20 for applicants, 3 for every public testimony. 3 minutes for every public testimony, 20 for the applicant. It was very organized. And I think that both hearings examiners are going to use that now, so it will be in line with what council and planning commission uses. And they have implemented it again for tonight's land use hearing, and so I think that they will continue doing that. But in our Title 40, the hearings examiner has the authority to run the hearing with time limits if they want.
20 minutes per applicant. What about staff?
I don't know if he implemented one for staff, but I can't. I mean, I've been in every land use hearing in the last year, and staff has never gone over 20 minutes.
Okay.
And then there's rebuttal times, and the record stays open for a week at least. I mean, with Washougal Pit, it's much longer than that, but the record will continue to stay open.
So open record regardless of what's being heard.
So far, that's how they've been doing that. Yes. But I wanted to give you
if it's hybrid or remote, is what's been happening. That's what came out of that format.
Yeah.
Jamie also noted on April's point, no time limitations on staff, and it worked really well.
Good.
Yeah.
Thank you for that.
And going back to the mention of biannuals, so you said any topics that Deeb has that we want to run in this cycle of biannual updates, we have to get to her within the next 30 days. So that's
by the next Deeb meeting.
By the next Deeb meeting.
Can you add the ones that we already asked to add from the last time?
Yes, but can you get them in one list?
What were they?
It was mixed use, was talking about mixed use.
I think that's being addressed in the housing. I think a lot of it is being addressed.
It is not. You know what happened? No. Here's what happened. And we're going to touch on this later. But they did this.
Yeah.
They did this. We, as staff said, they should do it with the housing options. And housing options said they're doing it through biannual, so we're not touching this.
Yep. It's in
the
our...
The townhomes coming out of the multi...
That one is in the housing options.
Okay. Not the only one, but the definition in the cottage code that didn't make it. The landscape stuff didn't make it. So those pieces didn't make it in, which were biannual. And then we also bumped something with road mod or something else.
We did bump the road mods. We discussed that at length last meeting with no resolution, I don't believe. Staff was had some pretty good arguments for maintaining the road modifications that they currently have, and not pursuing a more prescriptive way of addressing some of those items.
Jennifer analyzed, I think she said she analyzed the last road mods for the last 6 months, and they were
all different.
Different.
Yeah.
To be able to prescribe. They tried. Okay. Her and David Darby together.
So what I think we should do on those, the ones that affect the housing options, we should do both. We should notice them as if we're doing biannuals, and if we do end up covering them with the housing options code, because we're going to have testimony on that as well, we should try both. Since neither, we went with neither, now we should try both and notice it in case they do get bumped. All the worst case, we remove it from the biannuals.
There you go.
And there's no risk. But if we don't add it, then we haven't noticed it properly. So let's add the housing ones from last time that got bumped. The cottage.
Well, we're going to have the housing options, you know.
We're going to discuss it, yes. Yeah, but I think we should add those. So
I just was wondering when those are going to be proposed to be in.
And I think part of that housing also was the definition of gross floor area that needed to be resolved.
It's a fire code. We'll talk about that a little bit.
Okay.
You're proposing changes. There are some changes that might be bigger than biannual.
Significantly bigger.
Yeah.
That's not, though. That's just a definition.
Yeah.
Definition.
So from the meeting minutes from last month, Mr. Galimo has noticed some miscommunications between some groups on issues like cottage code, for example. The Middle Housing Options Committee wouldn't deal with the garages in the cottage code because it was going through the biannuals. And then the biannual said the issue would go through the middle housing. There has been some back and forth finger pointing. Mr. Palermo wanted to bring it back up and suggest coming up with a recommendation for the two departments to communicate.
If they're not going to address it, I do not feel like that's a biannual code amendment.
You do not feel that that is a biannual code amendment?
No.
We had it in there last time.
So the definition?
It's just a definition.
The 1,600 square feet?
Yeah.
Gross floor.
Right.
So
just strike in the word gross.
Where does it fall?
Floor area.
How do we address it?
No other jurisdiction that I looked at in the state of Washington has a cottage bigger than 1,600 square feet. They mostly say 1,200 square feet plus garage, which is the same thing.
There's 1,500 square foot in the center.
With garage?
And garage is held up there. I think in the city of Vancouver, it's
12. It's 12
and
King.
And
so garage. Are we wasting our time discussing this then?
No, I think we should make a recommendation. I think we should request that it's added as something.
And okay. Or go through a type 4 process with it.
We had it in the biannuals last time, but we just pulled it because of the housing option stuff.
Yeah.
I think we let the counselors decide.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's right, like that's what we're charged to do is just to make recommendations, and then at that point,
yeah.
It's for the counselors to choose if it's something that they feel is worth merit or not.
Okay, then, are we going to recommend that it be added to the biennials?
Yes.
Okay. Then we will need to provide that as part of our list before the next meeting. Can you provide some language for that?
We already have it. We had it from the last biennial. We'll just bring it back in.
Last time.
Yeah, we just bumped it to the next one to let the housing options do its thing.
So I think with that then, though, is it would be important to provide some... We've talked about it a ton, but when it goes to counselors, then it's important to be able to summarize the rationale behind the change. That will be critical, because otherwise it doesn't necessarily make sense.
There's always a rationale for the biennials.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was a mistake of the language. We used the term in that code. We pulled it from a different jurisdiction, and they had a different definition of gross floor area than we did. That was it.
I did the research into it. The original ordinance said 1,200 plus garage. The original cottage code, when it was written, said 1,200 plus garage, and then they turned it into 1,600 through the process. It was like 2009.
I do have the. I remember there was 12,000, but there was never a garage in there. I don't believe.
So
I remember
1,200.
I have everything in my files. I have all the discussion from that.
But
I need to dig it out.
Yeah, I have it.
Just for the record, I'll just quickly say that it's related to the fact that in building a structure, the appraisal side of trying the cost of building a 1,200 square foot home and trying to appraise a 1,200 square foot home, because you have the same high cost items, which is kitchen, bathrooms, and heating and whatnot. Those items are all still there within 1,200 to 1,600, and your cost difference between the two is very minimal, and it makes it very difficult to get financing on a 1,200. You're trying to provide affordable housing product, and it really handicaps the ability to provide that based off the fact of financing not being readily available for that type of product. And so the purpose isn't to try and... I want to make sure the intent is to be able to provide affordable housing because of the fact it helps on the appraising side, because appraisers are going to have a difficult time providing the high enough value for the cost to build that home when the cost doesn't change that much between a 1,200 home to a 1,600 square foot home, which is why we don't see smaller ranches today, is because that cost difference. You're just able, adding that additional square footage is very minimal in cost, and an appraiser just looks at that and they go price per square foot, and it just makes it difficult. So that's the reason why for the 1,600 square foot request. It's not because of another agenda of trying to make it big or more expansive or things of that nature. It's just about being functional to work within, unfortunately, how the financing system works with appraisals and whatnot, and the cost to build. So
I understand that, and I do hear what you're saying, but the cottage code is written with the purpose of to promote sustainable development practices through smaller, more effective, and efficient housing and use of residential land. Diversify the county's housing stock by providing a housing type that is affordable and that responds to changing household sizes and ages, such as retirees, small families, and single parent households. To encourage development in existing residential areas by allowing a density bonus and design flexibility. And it goes on. But it's in the purpose. So that's why
I feel like things I said, though, just match that purpose, though, quite a different, a few categories. Like, I think it's, we can have something that we would idealistically like to have, but unfortunately, if we can't get the financing, whether it be to build it or the financing for a buyer to buy it, it doesn't, it unfortunately, I mean, yes, I would, I agree. If we could get to a 1,200 square foot product that we could do, that would be, hey, I would build it all day. The problem is I just, there isn't, I can't either get the financing for it, for what a bank will see when I appraise it, when I go to build it, and I get the loan to build it. I can't get that financing, and then the buyer can't get that financing. And that's the problem, is that barrier. So I agree with you. There is a huge demand for it. I don't know, it just sucks the fact that we can't. We just can't. We used to. I mean, I was selling a 1,300 square foot house that was a ranch that was a perfect product for someone wanting to downsize. Perfect. And I was at $132,000. And I can't get there. And it's not, my profit percentage goes down with my total cost. So it's not my profit percentage is higher, it's down. So, yeah. Because that product will sell. And it's demand, and it will do well. It's just a bummer on the financing. It's just we can't get there.
We're also seeing a lot of projects not move forward because the code doesn't work with the market segment. And like Terry said, if you can't get it financed, you're not going to build it. But we're not going to have affordable housing. So we need to make sure that when we do something, we have it's practical to actually do in the field. And what we're seeing is no one's building them right now. There's a few. And one of them is
I'm going to try and build 14.
Okay.
I have them at 1,596 square feet, and it is, I'm touch and go. I got laundry closets. I'm going to have a stacked laundry unit that I have to put in, and just all those different things. I mean, it's going to be very, very, very tight. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great point. Because now we have to figure in a mechanical room, and we didn't have to do that before. When you're that small, that does.
We're going to do split mini splits. There's new product available.
So that helps.
But we're going to be under 1,500 square feet of conditioned space.
Conditioned space.
You know, we'll have a 209 square foot. I have got the tiniest little garage that, I mean, it's like, I don't know anybody's going to put anything other than a Prius in it. You know? Yeah.
And that's the problem with the impact of the density and then not being able to put a car in your on-site, you end up having more impact to the neighbors. So there's really not a lot of downside to having a garage on there because it provides storage, so you don't have junk sitting in your yard. Because these are tiny, they're small homes. You're gonna have that, and you're gonna have cars, and they're gonna park in the neighbors' streets because we didn't adequately plan on site for being able to store a car in your garage. So there is reasons why, and you know, depending on where they're located, even if it's near transit, people still have cars, and they also collect bikes and other things that they need to store somewhere. When you have a smaller home, you have more of a need for a garage. So saying that you can't do the garage, and if you do, it counts against the square footage to make it even smaller, where you need even more storage space. It counteracts where it's that product's not going to get used. They're going to go to a different product. So all of our work trying to find affordable housing doesn't happen. And that's kind of where we're at. And if it does, it's not a product that people really want anymore. It might be that's all they're stuck with because they can't afford anything else either because of other factors in our community right now. So that's a lot of the stuff we're looking at is you know, they relate. So,
how do we want to make sure that we get everything to April?
I would like to just make a motion now that we add the two items that got bumped from the last biannuals, and we just put that language back in for this time.
So to be clear, what are the two items?
Landscaping and the cottage code.
Landscaping on multifamily.
Yeah. The cottage code.
Landscaping and multifamily and the cottage code. And is there anything on mixed use or no?
Did we have that?
We
don't have that.
I did not see that included in the...
It wasn't last time.
We discussed it.
You brought it up. That's new.
Yeah, it's new in that we were proposing to update the development standards for mixed use to essentially change a category for townhomes.
That's happening, I believe, in the housing options.
It's not clear. So let's talk about that when it comes up. And if we need to include that.
Landscape versus rec space?
No.
Okay.
That one should go back in the biennials.
But that has to go through a type 4.
Because the council has already established that that's a policy.
Okay, so...
It can't be in the bylaws. So I don't know who... So it's community development that needs to take... Or,
it is, but there's
planning.
An application that you have to... You have to suggest it to them.
Couldn't that be suggested then? Can we do what we have to do to do that? Can we have our staff liaison do the notice then?
I have to see what a type 4. I don't do type 4.
Okay, so can we get that submitted? Whatever we have to do as a board to do that, can we submit that to get the process rolling?
Yeah.
If you're talking about angle, we have to
submit that. That's for the shared outdoor recreational space.
Probably,
and landscape.
Maybe we make a formal motion of that then.
So moved.
we need the motion to understand what the motion is.
The motion is to apply for the code change for the type
just one
4 process.
Just one
that April mentioned for the landscaping multifamily.
I will second that wholeheartedly.
Okay. All right. Motion and second. All those in favor?
Aye. Jamie? He's not on right.
What's the landscaping thing you were talking about then to get to buy-in?
That was the one I was talking about, the landscape multifamily. Yeah, same one. We had it in the biennials last time. The cottage one should be on there, yes.
And then I'd like to note mixed use, and it may be something that is already covered, and if it is, we can pull
we'll
it.
We'll find out today.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Sounds good.
It is.
Okay, we move on.
Yep.
All right. Well, the next item is the residential light design code.
Jamie.
Oh.
Okay.
Jamie's got his hand up.
Can you? Sorry,
he's
there. He is.
Yeah. He said
I. Okay. Okay.
Did you turn off?
All right. April, would you cover the residential light design code?
I saw that someone added this.
Yeah.
So we had a constituent that came to a public hearing that talked about outdoor lighting in residential areas. So we have a commercial code for outdoor lighting, but we don't have a residential code for outdoor lighting, and it was suggested that that's something that maybe Dean could help us through.
What is their position on the lighting? They want light or they don't want light?
It's called, well, there's a really extensive light code that I don't know if we would want to adopt the extensiveness of it, but it has a lot of good background, and it's called Night Skies,
yes.
And it's Island County.
Okay.
And so that would be, there's a city that does it really well, too.
So, are there concerns that there is too much light?
Yes.
Yeah, that's
and
about
or that it's pointing at them. So that somebody's landscaping is pointing in their window.
I'm going somewhere with this. Clark County does not require streetlights as part of their transportation standards. City of Vancouver does. Other jurisdictions do. Clark County does not. So that should be made clear to the constituent. Number one. Number two, is this a residential area only question, or is it a commercial question as far as lighting?
No, we have commercial lighting codes.
Okay. So what is it that they're trying to regulate? Or want us to chime in as far as some sort of code?
Rural landscaping lighting that could be offensive to the neighbors, and more of a rural lighting or landscape, oh my gosh, not codes, but mixed uses.
A standard or?
Standards. It's not something that I think that my code enforcement could take care of,
enforce,
but standards,
right.
that people build to.
So if you say you wanted to put a security light out in front of your garage and in your driveway, do you need to get a permit to do that?
No.
So.
And the public testimony was that their neighbors landscaping light was directly in their window, and they tried to resolve it, and it's not being resolved through communication between the two. And if there was a design standard for it, then people would comply.
Well, if a design standard for something that doesn't require a permit is complicated, though.
And it can be considered a safety thing.
Yeah.
Like, and there's areas that you have to dam for. You have to light paths that you can't see from both ends. That's always like an issue, having kind of blind corners for crime, things like that. I would say if there is something proposed, we would review it. I don't know that it's gotten that far yet, but we can keep it on our radar. And right now,
rural areas.
I guess my thought would be is in all my time of selling real estate and dealing with different property owners, I've never heard of a complaint personally. So if it was something that became I wouldn't want to add code related to one single complaint or a very low amount of complaints, but if it was something that was a predominant issue, or we had a high amount of rural development and things of that nature, I mean, definitely needs to be something that we look at.
I don't know, if my neighbor had one that a light that was just going on motion and it tried to run in my window, I'd just go knock on the door and ask them if they could point it a different way, and it'd be resolved.
I'm guessing they did, and the person said no.
So, yeah. You know, it's hard to make regulations on people that aren't being reasonable with each other, and we end up creating a bunch of stuff that's not necessarily needed, that has more adverse impacts. Yeah.
The public, the constituents' thought process and what they said was, I'm not asking you to send code enforcement out, but if you had a design code for Clark County, people would follow it.
Have you looked, do other counties have lighting design codes for rural areas?
Well, Island County, for sure. It's mostly a cities thing. A lot of cities do.
Yeah.
Let me see, hold on.
Urban areas.
Spokane County, and actually Pierce County just added one. It's 18J, I've got it. They just added it this year when they did a code update. So that was interesting to me that Pierce just did it.
Mention these other jurisdictions in their
public comment?
Yes.
Burien has a very extensive one. It's called Night Skies. It's not only for the only reason for neighbor to neighbor, but also it is to conserve night skies.
And that's a pretty common thing.
Yes. Yeah. So I saw it in a lot of city jurisdictions. No, King County doesn't have it. Pierce just added it this year. Snohomish says this is a civil issue. Spokane has one. It's not very extensive, and the city of Vancouver has some, but only commercial, actually. Nothing in the city about it.
If there's some proposed language, I think we should review it.
Sure. If somebody wants to propose something to us, that's another reason why we're here, is that the public can come to us and recommend something that we review. Very similar to... you know, if there's a code interpretation issue, they can come to us when we can provide our opinion.
What is this in our packet?
That's the commercial.
That's commercial. That's what's in our code now.
That's the commercial.
This is not in our code.
This is 17. I don't know what.
This is not in our code. Yeah. This list is
unincorporated Island County.
Island County.
This was on the email.
Oh, okay.
So looking at this and trying to apply this in a rural area, you have so many different scenarios, whether it's, you know, somebody on smaller lots, large lots, and there's looking and trying to apply, you know, is this 800 lumens or less, and is it shining onto a neighbor's property? Like, there's so many variables with this that I feel like even if we had a design standard, it would be very difficult, you know, to resolve something, you know, when you look at, you would say someone like a layman who's not familiar with, you know, these different intensities or, you know, some of the standards with that.
And how do you enforce it?
Yeah.
So typically, I mean, this comes up on HOAs occasionally. It's a very somewhat rare thing. It depends on your community. So I deal with, I don't know, 4 to 6 HOAs at the moment. Some of the HOAs will have this light provision, and granted, these HOAs are typically in an urban area. This is much more applicable to urban that we've dealt with than it is rural. So
closer proximity.
Closer proximity. If you have floodlights, something might be shining into some of these properties. So the HOA, typically, if they can't handle it, it goes to an HOA. HOA, the border manager, looks at the codes. If it's over 800 lumens, it's a spotlight, it's this, this, and that. It's handled. Or if that's not there, it goes under a general nuisance provision, and it's handled that way. I would be very reluctant to put a code, a design standard into county if there's no intention to enforce it with code enforcement.
Because that's
then you're just setting up a whole bunch of civil lawsuits.
That's where I'm going, thinking. So if there's no enforcement.
That would be my comments. It comes up on HOAs occasionally, and it's by communities. I know, I grew up in HOA in Arizona. They're very tight on their lights. It has, a lot of the same verbiage, 800 lumens, floodlights, and shining on the HOAs. So, it's helpful in urban, but it's usually handled with HOAs.
I think with Island County, and the reason why that one came up is because that was the night skies one. For them is for more rural.
Yeah, and it's
mm-hmm. and it's for preservation.
It's preservation. It's a less dense county. It's irrigation or Island County as well.
I don't like to propose language on one-offs. I don't any kind of code or regulation of any kind on a one-off.
I don't. I obviously, if someone's shining a floodlight at someone else's house, that's not being obviously a good neighbor, and it's not how they would want to be treated themselves. 800 lumens, just me being a layman in that regard, can someone give me a sense of what 800 lumens would be comparable to?
8 watt LED
bulb. Okay.
So I think that's
the equivalent of 60
watts.
60 watts. That's pretty small.
That's really small.
Because you could have a side light in a garage door that could literally then trip that. So you could have someone who just doesn't like you. And that's my concern, is someone picks a fight over, and then all of a sudden you're creating what could be a civil issue. I guess I would definitely want to, if without my understanding of lumens and the actual strength of the light, I would definitely, to me, would want to be something more extreme that you're trying to stop, where someone is being
malicious.
It still wouldn't even fix that situation, because this is a lighting standard for new development. They'd be vested.
Gotcha.
So it wouldn't even apply. This would be on new structures and new developments. There'd be nothing to trigger this code for an existing neighborhood or situation. Mm-hmm. So what they probably would have is this maybe isn't the wrong place. This isn't a development standard thing. It's a, you could do a, like kind of a neighborly code or something that would be applied to everyone retroactively just to,
like a noise ordinance.
Like a noise ordinance.
Yeah.
It'd be more like a noise ordinance. I think it's maybe something different. Like a light. Yeah.
Is there a WAC that addresses, because I know there's a WAC that addresses noise levels. Between different uses, there might be one associated with light that they could go to as far as.
From what I can find, no, not for residential buffer. But I put all other jurisdictions in, and I didn't put a WAC, so I go there first. So I don't think so.
I just see this like being one more level that can add to the cost too. Now maybe we're doing some kind of a fancy lighting plan. How do we ensure that when we're doing development?
Yeah.
This is kind of outside, I think, what we would recommend. However, say if someone feels strongly and they're adopting it, we may want to comment on it. But I don't know. I think there's more adverse impacts. And it's a one-off. It's someone who really should just talk to their neighbor and ask them to take the light away. And I know they did. But you know what? You can't regulate bad
mean people.
You just can't regulate. I don't know.
People.
There's always going to be someone.
Just a bad actor.
I mean, how is dog poop in someone's yard regulated now? Because it's similar. You know, if someone does that, you should be a good neighbor and pick it up. And how is that in the law? This is similar. I think it should be handled like that, or a noise ordinance, not a development standard. that, I guess, would be kind of our position. I don't even know if we need a motion.
And I think it is in a rural setting. I understand that not every there's a little, things that lie outside of a homeowner association, but that to me does seem like a much better way of handling it is having a homeowner association and then adding that. If it's not within your CCNRs, then look to add it to your CCNRs to be able to handle more smaller community focus. And it's adding that burden onto Clark County to be involved in something like that. That's something that Clark County is never going to be able to have the time or resources to enforce.
And then there's the if it does happen retroactive, how are you going to get those properties that have the high pressure sodium lights for their yards and their barns and stuff? All of a sudden, they have to take them down.
Oh, I used to have floodlights in my backyard because I had the kids over and they would play baseball and kickball in my backyard.
Right.
And they were very powerful.
For argument's sake, it's in other jurisdictions design
code. Yeah. It be that as it may.
Be interesting to see if jurisdictions are requiring for their metric plans with their with their submittals.
So I guess what we can say is this: if that's kind of the consensus, is that we don't necessarily want to undertake this as a new development code, but should a citizen want to present something, I mean, the citizens can always present something to the council. They can present something to us. We can opine.
The citizen provided this.
Okay. This is what the citizen has provided to us.
I think our position would be this isn't something that we would pursue that would make it more difficult and could have adverse impacts.
And we would need to find out from code enforcement whether or not they would be willing to then go out at night in order to determine whether or not someone is in compliance or not.
The 800 lumens to me would be the thing. It would be looking at what the strength of the light is. Because that, to me, would a 60-watt bulb on a because you have that on a side light on cert when you come out of a side door of a garage or off of your back patio or whatnot, that's going to be a 60-watt bulb that a lot of times will sit next to your door. So I guess I wouldn't want to limit someone from having that. To me, it would need to be a stronger light than that that would be limited, because that doesn't seem reasonable. But maybe my understanding of what 800 lumens is incorrect.
Yeah, strong flashlights. I have flashlights 1,000 lumens. I mean, it's not that much light.
Gotcha. So, do we move on from this, or and I guess if the citizen really wanted to do it, they could go through a code process. They could submit that same thing we are for the landscape code.
That's true.
Type 4 process.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, we would review it if something is formally proposed, but it's not something that we're recommending.
And I would encourage them to listen to our discussion on this. We just haven't, you know,
poo-pooed it.
There's some significant issues associated with coming up with development regulations associated with rural lighting.
So, Mike, one thing, just want to make sure, it's mentioned on the agenda as a council suggestion. If it's a request from the council that they're looking for our input on this,
council is looking for
it. I think it would be good
if
we provide a response.
So, a response to council then would be we do not recommend having a new code for an issue like this, which is kind of a one-off dispute between properties. And we encourage them to work it out.
And for all the reasons that we've explained.
Yeah.
In enforcement, coming up with the standards to begin with, And again, it comes to that one off. If there was a group of people that are like, that were organized and said, hey, you know, we have a real issue out in rural Clark County. I mean, you go out to rural Clark County, it's just 10 minutes north of Hazeldale. And you look up and you can see the stars. I love it. And I'm in Hazeldale and I can look up and I see a few stars. But, you know, I think that this comes from a neighborly dispute or something that's kind of a one-off. And I just don't see the necessity to have a development code on predicated on a one-off.
In the last 4 years, we've had five residential-to-residential complaints. Now, we currently do not, code enforcement does not enforce it, but we did record three light complaints, residential to residential, in 2021 and two in 2022, and then we have one for 2023.
In urban or rural?
Rural.
It doesn't say.
I would assume it's urban, but.
The one we got this year is rural.
Okay. So I want to add is if someone has. I live on a lot, and we have a residential lot, it's 7,500 square feet, and. We had lighting that went to a green space, and it was for kids to play basketball. And we had a neighbor that complained who was older that was upset about it interrupting their sleep and whatnot. And it was so we came up with the thing of like, hey, we won't have the lights on past a certain time. But that wasn't direct light because our house was further back than their house. It was a matter of light reflecting off of leaves. I'd hate to have it be where someone doesn't like kids playing, and they literally have a light shining for them to play, and then it becomes a way for someone to enforce so kids can't play at night. Now, there needs to be reasonable hours, and maybe I don't see that. You know, maybe that's something that could be added. But that would be, I guess that's where I get really fearful of is someone takes this as a way of enforcing someone else's ability to have use of their property that's reasonable. And I get really, that's concerning to me. Especially if, as it relates to kids. Now if it's someone who just has a billion lights on their property and it's obnoxious, yeah, I get that. But I don't know how to, as this is written, I don't see the ability to discern that. That's my concern. So that's where the heart of my concern is that.
I also think it's not going to correct the problem because these are development standards, not like a noise ordinance. And one of the recommendations we could give to council is that we don't feel there should be a development regulation that you have to jump through when you're doing a land use application or something, because it's almost impossible to know what's going to be built. You end up with just a note on the plan saying follow this code, because you don't know what light it's the homeowners are going to put in. But if it's done in a different way, like a noise ordinance or something like that, if they really feel that it's that big of an issue, it's not a development regulation. It's a code, and then it applies to existing homes.
That makes sense.
As well, yeah, as new homes, because this would not solve that problem. So we're creating a solution that does not solve that problem because it's still unenforceable. Because when they put that light in,
that makes sense.
They don't fall into this development code. They're vested. And the person who proposed it, the neighbor, probably doesn't have that same level of expertise on development regulations and how they're applied, and that they can only be applied to new proposals, not existing like homes. So it needs to be in a different place. If this is a real problem we're trying to solve, it should be like a noise ordinance, not a development standard. So we can make that recommendation. We can maybe move on.
I agree with that.
Since we have some council representation, is there anything that we'd want to add as far as, are we addressing questions? Or are we not addressing it in the fashion desired?
Yeah. Maybe have them chime in.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, and Glenn.
I can say a couple of things.
Sure.
So I live in a rural area, and development is coming right up to rural areas. On 179th and 11th on the west side of I-5, across the street from a development that's occurring there are Ag 40 and Ag 20 properties. And so that lighting will affect that area. So I'm glad that you enjoy the evening sky. But a fear that I have, because for me, you know, this issue coming up, it was more about the dark, preserving the dark skies. So that's a concern of mine personally. There is opportunities for people in the rural area to have lights put up because there aren't a lot of lights. I rather like it that way. But our neighbor had a light put up, and we just called the PUD and asked if they could screen it. And they came out the next day and put a screen on, all's well. So there may be some simple solutions to deal with this. But as the urban area is getting closer to the rural area, it's having an impact.
What about street light? I mean, to me, then it would seem kind of relative to what you're talking about would be, you know, what street lights are. Because I know, like, you typically have to in some areas of different street light requirements. It helps with what you're talking about as far as night sky.
Right, there are different designs, and a concern I had is what if this would, the cost, it would be cost prohibitive.
It would be good to explore.
Right.
I have no... Because this hasn't been something that's in our area, I have no idea of... I know we've had difficulties with getting just regular streetlights, so that would be my other concern, is inventory.
They're always shielded.
I think PUD, they're always shielded down?
They are.
Okay.
Yeah, the streetlights are shielded down. Unless they're something that a homeowners association did, is they wanted, like, pole lights that don't have the same... They still have somewhat shield. But they are usually pointed down.
Do acorn lines shield down?
No.
They have a top shield.
They have a top shield.
They have a top shield.
Yeah. But they do anymore.
But the sideways, you do get a little more sideways light out of the acorn style.
But the acorn have to be the really, they're the, 2000 Kelvin or something like that. They have to be the warm.
Oh, not a bright light, but
yeah,
a warm
light. Yeah, they can't be the white lights. They have to be the orangish, yellow color.
Right.
Okay. Yeah.
The cobra headed lights are obviously going to really specifically shine down more so than.
Mm-hmm.
And those are obviously readily available.
But I think
just real quick.
Yeah.
For me, I think that I got a little bit different perspective out of this. The gentleman brought in this picture that was very compelling. I don't know what this guy had in his yard, but it was a beacon. And it was like thousands of feet away. I mean, it looked like that in the picture, but it took a picture of the side of his house, and you could see every little bush, every little thing on the shadows of his house. And so, I don't know if the process of how to move forward is, but also in terms of complaints, if there is no code that people are violating, you can't really file a complaint. So it could be a bigger problem than we know of.
So was this that a new come? Construction, a new house that was built, or somebody added a light to an existing house?
I don't know. And so after this discussion, I think code-wise, I think you're right. I think it's more ordinance.
It's
a different direction. It shouldn't be a development code. It should be an ordinance, like a noise ordinance.
Yeah, but it's something that would be suggested just to keep that light going downward instead of going straight out to the side or something. I don't know.
And because then it would affect existing conditions.
Yes.
But I would just say you're doing exactly, I think, what the county was looking for and giving us advice,
sure.
Just kicking this around.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. With that, we'll move on to the housing options implementation and the proposed code amendments. This is draft code language, so Jose requested just an initial presentation today and then a follow-up longer presentation at our next month's meeting. So with that, I'll turn it over to Jose.
Hi, everybody. Jose's actually not here today, so Susan and I are. But essentially, we wanted to check in, provide you all of the materials, the draft code we went to a public meeting at the end of March and are being Can everyone hear me? Just want to make sure.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Because it's been hard to hear you all, I will say. So let me know if there were things that we should have answered, we might not have heard. So April, feel free to reach out to me if there are things that we can provide information on that were brought up today. Thank you. That being said, so today, essentially, we just want to keep this brief. We want to get you all the documentation that we have before, that are joined before the Planning Commission, so the first step of the Type 4 legislative process, to have you have the opportunity to kind of be able to review it. And then we're going to have Elizabeth, our consultant, Elizabeth Decker from JET Planning, who drafted the code language, come to your meeting in May. And she'll go through the presentation that we have and be able to get into any in-depth code questions or discussions that you want to have at that point. So today, Susan and I aren't planning on presenting anything. We just wanted to kind of prep you that we plan to come back in May. You should have all the information now that we provided to staff, and we'll be back in May to go through that and answer any questions and have that discussion.
Oh, she's still talking.
Up here. Just making sure. Any questions for us?
So, when is this being adopted? Or going to hearing?
Going to the Planning Commission next.
You can do it now.
You can do it now.
Okay. When is it due before adoption? So, I guess my goal would be when do we need to have our formal recommendations to staff or the council to be incorporated into the record? So what's our timeline?
Oh, hold on, Jackie. We have to switch.
Okay. Planning Commission hearing is scheduled for May 18th. Is that right, Susan? That's Thursday. I'm going to check.
Work session?
Yes. May 18th is the Planning Commission's hearing. And then for council, we have it tentatively scheduled for June 20th for this first batch. And then I will just give just a quick FYI reminder. Eric might have already mentioned it, but we are going to start our second batch with the technical code for a series on multifamily and regulated affordable housing strategies that were short term in the action plan. That will start on April 25th. We'll utilize the kind of the same process we did for the first batch.
It doesn't, I've been pretty involved in the code. I think what we need to do is maybe create kind of a subgroup to make our comments. Unfortunately, I am out of the country on the June 20th, but someone else here maybe can represent our interests at that hearing, or we can do something written.
I've reviewed this. On the surface, something.
There's some good things in here, and they do help. There's some potentially. I think one of the things that we need to look at are unintended consequences of new language, like we did on the code, the cottage code. I can tell you, I was here for the discussion on the cottage code. We always had garages in all of our examples. We never counted them against the square footage. We had them on all of them.
There was, but it was 1,200 plus garage.
And then the recommendation was independent of that because, but I'm going to look through my notes. I'm not going to say for sure because I'm going off my memory, and your memory can tell you. I do have notes of that. So.
And this isn't my forte.
Yeah.
As far as the housing.
But what I guess I'd like to do is before the next D meeting, maybe we had, I pulled this from my files. This was our recommendation. The D made comments on the Housing Action Plan in April 7th, 2022. I think at the least we should review our recommendations and make sure those recommendations made it into the final language of the code.
Oh.
So we have, this isn't, we don't have to reinvent the wheel. We have very specific recommendations on all of the short-term, near-term strategies. This was the concept. We made the recommendations. Those then get brought into the code language. So now we're in the next step. So what we should do is look at our recommendations.
Excellent idea.
Against the code. And, you know, see if they were addressed. And we can directly do that.
Offline.
Yes. So what I'd say is, who would like to be on that subcommittee?
I would.
Okay, I would as well.
Working on.
I will respectfully disassociate myself.
I can participate in that.
You can? Okay.
Good.
So I guess we're going to just form a group, us three of us, and we will. I'll take a crack at it. Maybe circulate some things around. Maybe we can meet if we need to.
Do you have a? Do you have this electronically?
Yes, you do.
Set that up?
Yep.
Awesome. If you could send that out to all of us, then we'll all take a look at it and provide our own initial comments on it.
Can I also say take a special look at the compact lot developments?
That's all new.
Because if it allows more than 1,200 or more than 1,600 square feet with a garage, that might also accommodate.
Be an option.
And that is going to be.
Yeah, I would say that the cottage code, the way that the overall code is being proposed, the cottages will be the red-haired stepchild going forward, because it's so much easier to develop as a townhouse and not have all the open space and distractions with all the different restrictions that you're just going to develop it as townhouses.
I do think that this code is still going to get a lot of public scrutiny.
Yeah.
Because by nature, it is changing the character of our community, and we are packing more density into zones. It is basically upzoning most of the county.
Yep. Yeah.
And it is a big deal. And it does impact existing neighborhoods, and I think it's going to be a heated one, I think.
I was hoping to ask Jamie a question, because House Bill 1110 is being proposed and looks like it's going to pass through the state legislature.
Yep.
And it does not, the way I understand it, is it does not directly affect Clark County because it's not a city. Right? I mean,
I think it's based on public transportation, access to public transportation.
But it's all the code notes that I've read says city, so it doesn't
say urban area.
It doesn't say, there's some growth management areas that are, if you have a city that is directly attached to a growth management area that's greater than 275,000, but it doesn't say county, and I don't know if county staff has looked at that and said, okay, no, we are exempt from this at this time.
We're in a little bit of an anomaly in Clark County, where a large portion of urban development exists not in a city boundary. Mm-hmm. And that does not happen across the state, really. So when they say cities, the intent a lot of times is urban areas. And when we zone to urban areas, we have city standards inside of Clark County. And it puts a lot more burden on Clark County, where counties don't have urban areas.
Well, the House Bill 1110 is going through, and it's basically saying you have to allow duplexes, and if you have, you know, population above this, you got to go to a sixplex if you're within this kind of, you know, urban transportation area.
You can allow.
You have to allow them.
You have to allow. So they're mandating that's a housing option that somebody could do.
So a single family lot, boom. All of a sudden, all the stuff that we've talked about in this housing option study, a lot of it ends up just being the increased density is a state mandate that's coming.
We're ahead of it, which is a good thing.
We're being more proactive.
Yeah.
Clark County is. Mm-hmm. So do we want to let Jamie chime in on House Bill, what'd you say, 1110?
1110.
1110. Jamie?
Sorry. Who's going to say aye?
Yeah.
Is that?
Aye.
Maybe Jackie, or they can't hear me right now, but maybe Jackie or Susan, though. Jackie or Susan, give me a minute before you answer, because we have to do this unmute thing. But what was the
House Bill 1110?
1110. Does it apply to us?
from what I've read, and I'm not a lawyer, and I wouldn't, I'd consult with our PAs if this passes, but as it reads, it looks like it does not reference the county, it does reference a lot of cities. But we are tracking it as well, and if it goes into effect, we will have to take a look at that and see how that might impact the unincorporated urban area or not.
Thank you, Jackie.
Hey, Eric, do those recommendations you got from April 7th, do those apply to multifamily as well?
The recommendations that we made?
Yeah, that we made. I wasn't there. That's the only reason I'm asking.
Yeah, you weren't part of it.
I don't think so.
No, because it wasn't one of their things. We may have mentioned it. Let me take a look. Advisement on parking requirements, advised cottage code. Oh, no, we do.
Yeah,
HOA. So, as part of this, as part of the middle housing options, they're reducing the required amount of landscaping because you can't, you cannot build more density without decreasing the amount of landscaping. You can't get the same units. So, yes, it is in there. But I don't know how it's in the language. We need to read through this all.
Yeah, so I signed up to be on that one, too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So if I could get those, I can...
Yeah, we don't have that language yet in this packet, but I will. I'll get you... This is on our records, but I'll send it to the rest of the board. I'll make a note of that.
Yeah. Awesome.
Yep.
I can try to represent it, at least.
Yep.
I'm a glutton for punishment.
So we could say then with what the county is pursuing with this code change kind of follows in the spirit of that bill.
What, you trying to get ahead of what the state was going to regulate?
Yeah.
I think I have like in boxes in my office. I was just cleaning it out. I have like pretty much every deed thing that we've worked on for
same here. Yeah. I've got 10 years more.
So I do have I can show like the stuff we talked about.
Can you look at this and see if the compact lot developments take care of the changes that you want to make in the cottage code before I put it into the biannual?
I still think regardless, no one will ever do a cottage if you can't, not ever, but it won't be widely used if we don't allow some type of a garage to count against it. And it might be a small thing that we have a threshold that's reasonable, but I do think regardless of if it's covered in there, what we're going to see is more go into the compact neighborhoods and less cottage because it fits the intent. Right now, we're trying to cram both under cottage, and some of the cottage developments that are happening are really this other code.
Correct.
And it does address it, but it's an issue for both. So,
yeah.
Yep.
With the compact lot development, they're limited to 3 acres.
Could you speak up, sorry?
Sorry. With the compact lot development, they're limited to 3 acres in site, and
that's
I've seen a lot of the cottage
on
bigger lots than 3 acres.
So yep, does not address it.
It's a PD.
Which is interesting because cottage was, I always thought of as an infill code, but.
No.
Exactly.
The other. more, I mean, there's a lot of stuff out there, 119th. I mean, there's.
Oh, yeah.
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 The other part that we need to make sure of is that a lot of this new code, how that dovetails with transportation standards, too. I know that the city of Vancouver has reduced standards as far as driveways, roadways, private roadways, things like that, as part of their infill ordinances.
That's in there's a narrow lot.
Yeah, but from the transportation side, we want to make sure that we're not trying to shoehorn something into something that's not attainable with regards to... you know, some kind of flexibility. I'm just kind of throwing that out there because that's one of those aspects of any land use that fails to get to be recognized that, oh, yeah, hey, there's the whole transportation aspect of it, too. You know, whether it be cross-circulation or differing standards as far as roadways are concerned, I'm not proposing anything specific right now,
right.
But I just want to make sure that we don't just look at this on an island as far as the land use is concerned and not kind of pull back and take a bigger view of the impacts of this vis-a-vis how we're going to you know, get people to and from these developments.
I think that this project has had a lot of input, and it's very, very long process it's gotten up to this point. And I think that the intent is to look at the supply that we've already talked about and the affordability, Econ 101, mm-hmm. and that, you know, this is an attempt to be able to effectively increase supply of housing, specifically the missing middle. Mm-hmm. I think our job is to look at this and say, okay, we've got a bunch of changes in here. And we need to put our expertise on there and say, what kind of conflicts are we going to see?
There
what's in there?
I get it.
And then one of the things that I propose as the code change, as in there is multifamily, says if there is any conflict, the staff shall interpret it as the most restrictive way.
Mm-hmm.
Since there's going to be all these changes, mm-hmm. I think that we should make a recommendation to the council that they should look at this and say, at least for the interim, for the next 2 years,
right.
when there's a conflict, it needs to take the least restrictive in an attempt to unburden the development so that more affordable housing can be created, and make code changes as we see these conflicts
sure.
that don't quite work.
That's always been the thought, is that, oh, well, we'll get it into practice and then we can change it later on. Man, that's way tougher than.
And that's why I said, let's make it to where it's like, let's make it the least restrictive.
Yeah.
I mean, there's code specifically written in multifamily that we've tripped over several
yep.
times now.
Yep.
We all know that this is going to be a very difficult transition. There's going to be missing consequences.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just make the recommendation going into it, try and have an attitude of, let's try and figure it out. A majority of developers do not want to take advantage of stuff. We want to try and figure out what we can make hit the market,
right.
be adaptable. And I mean, I know.
No, I agree.
You know, yeah. people that are sitting in here, we've all bashed our head against the wall trying to figure out something that can meet code and meet the market and make some money at it.
Yeah, exactly. I agree.
So.
Well, it has to be sustainable. One thought I had in regards to, there's never been the amount of housing bills that are presented this year that look like they will be, as of yesterday, we should have a sense of what bills made it through committee and what will be most likely approved. I think there was approximately look like somewhere around 10 bills related to housing that's going to create impacts for all jurisdictions. And so I think it would be good to get a sense of county staff's, I guess, a sense of impact to them. It's going to really have to do with when is the requirement of application going to be of those new bills that come through, which typically I believe are going to be June, which is fast for staff. So what are those? And then I'd like for the opportunity for Deeb to be able to help to provide some things that maybe would be considerations of, some things will be helpful on the supply side, but then what are some things that could be cause issues, whether it be on the staffing side for the county or code conflicts. So I think it would be helpful to talk about in our next meeting, is we'll know what bills were approved and to look at those. I think it's going to be too hard for staff to really have their arms around all those different things, but I think it would be good to look at and at least have an initial discussion about it. And it's something we're going to talk about more than once. But the intention on most of these codes, some I know one's in regards to permit streamlining. There's quite a few that are related to helping to ease inventory and create more inventory. And then some, like we just talked about, where the county isn't going to be applied because it was directed towards specifically city jurisdictions. So anyways, that was just something that I felt like it's going to be difficult for staff to be able to quickly respond depending upon the timing of application of these bills that are getting approved. In my experience since 2004, the amount of housing bills
coming through in 1 year is equal to 8 years combined.
That's a building code year.
Yeah.
It's a huge.
So,
a big,
so
big
I sympathize
change.
For staff, and I guess would like to be a resource as much as we can.
Yeah. My understanding on 11-10 is you have a year or a year and a half.
And that'd be great. And yeah, maybe there's going to be an ease in there to help with that. So hopefully it's not going to be...
Yeah, they have to.
It will be realistic for staffs and jurisdictions to be able to be prepared.
The idea was that it needed to be adopted in the zoning ordinance, which means public meetings.
Right.
All right. Well, that's the last item on our agenda. With that, I'll open it up for public comment. If there's anyone in the public, yes, go ahead.
Yes.
And so, as it moves forward, I guess, because it's a type of process, does the public understand what that process is? And then what will the public participation be in that process? Because since the beginning, that this was proposed as an annual ordinance, and then was put into the annual review, and then taken back out because of the policy, considered policy, as a policy issue, when it affects multi-family housing, and we need to look at the quality of life that we are creating for the residents in Clark County, we need to look at our middle housing options also, because we're talking about, you know, what size house are we going to build, how are we going to reduce the landscape, and what are we going to do with the garages. Now we're talking about one parking space, and then that means street parking. So we look at a lot of new developments. We have big homes, which is a lot of energy put into heating and cooling these big homes, and we're saying that landscaping isn't important to the public, and they just want big homes, and maybe that's not what the public wants, because there are a lot of 1,200 to 1,400 square foot homes that people are interested in. So to discount that, then of course there's always the question of, is it affordable, can you build it, and what's the profit you can make? But when we look at our housing, and according to looking at the tech forum and looking at the next multifamily aspect of the tech forum, it's supposed to have HOSAP project advisory group. Who is on that group? Are there members of the public that are participating in that group? And then it's supposed to have planning commission members. So what planning commission members are a part of that? And then it's supposed to have deed members. Well, it looks like today we formed a subcommittee of members. So when we're looking at our housing options, it needs to be looked through a broad lens of what is the quality of life that we are creating for the next 20 to 30 years for the residents of Clark County. And parking, transportation, landscape, availability to recreation. No family wants to move into a huge house with one garage space, one assigned parking, all the rest of the cars are on the street, and where do they send their children? Out on the street with all the cars parked on both sides? There's a component of this that we're leaving out, and that is quality of life. And quality of life includes many aspects. So as we go forward, and that involves landscaping and recreation, because if we're limiting our landscaping on our multifamily housing, and we're making it as little lot as possible, maybe building 2,000 square foot homes that we have to keep people. And then we're taking the same thing on our multifamily housing, and we want to limit how much landscaping and recreation. What's the quality of life within those ranges for housing in our moving forward in our community? And we don't have the public at the table.
the public gets an opportunity to participate 3 minutes at a planning commission meeting, not during the work sessions. 3 minutes at a hearing when it's already gone through a planning commission work session, no participation. Planning commission hearing, 3 minutes. Council work session, no participation. Hearing, now we're to the point where we're going to vote on it, council's going to vote on it, and the public gets 3 minutes. And now we're beginning to hear, well, we're going to limit that public participation to 20 minutes. If you guys are all here to talk about housing and what you want to see in housing, you have as a group 20 minutes. Where is the public input?
I would say we're part of the public. We're not staff.
There's a lot of development. You do represent development.
I have to ask a favor really quick. I'm the microphone, but I wasn't planning on it, so I'm about to run out of juice.
And I don't really...
So someone can call in.
I don't want to get into a discussion because we know it's not working. Probably I'm just the public. But it's a concern that we hear from groups that are out in the community as we move forward in the news.
April.
Just one thing, to tell you the truth, personally, I agree, and I have some of the same concerns you have about our community and the way it's moving. And one of the things that myself, while I'm involved, is I really want to protect the American dream. I want to make sure that people in our community have a place to live, that they can own
home ownership.
Home ownership. It's huge. It really affects some of the direction that good intentions are going, really impact probably marginalized communities the most, because they don't have that opportunity to own. We're forcing people, with some of our policy decisions, we're forcing them into being renters. And that is a huge deal, because affordability and making sure that people have a place to call home is a passion of mine. And we probably have the same goals, and we're trying to balance a lot of competing interests. And that's something we do. We really want to make sure that people have a place to call home. And love your suggestions, and we share some of the same
goals. There has to be a balance. We need to look at this from a more holistic viewpoint. And of course, we have a huge homeless problem, and we have to address that. But what, set that aside, lower middle income to middle income, and what's our current AMI, and what are we building towards, and what are the costs going to be when these projects are done, and are they really going to be affordable?
It's almost impossible right now to build
new energy
affordably.
Code.
The new energy code just
adds $26,000 to the construction house of a house.
It proportionally impacts small homes.
I mean, you're almost $200,000 into it before you build in a house. By the time you have a lot to build, especially in like Richfield.
It's close to 50%.
So
the city of Battleground's over 40 now, right?
Yep.
With
so
all the impact fees.
You got 130 to 150,000 to $180,000 a lot. So a lot of these houses are $200,000.
That's it. I know.
Before you even get a longer.
We used to have $10,000 was what it cost us to do site work on a townhouse stuff. The last one was $62,000 for site work.
If you go to Battleground, it's
and now it's not included. So
you go to Battleground, $62,000.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of regulation that's come up on it.
So building affordable housing is...
We build plenty of affordable housing, and we love to build affordable housing. I can't really talk bad about Missing Middle. You're the ones who brought, you're the first ones to bring the simple, attached housing to Clark County. It wasn't code for it. We actually had the city of Portland come in and work with them to do it.
Yeah.
So, we like to get a variety of products and serve everything we can possibly do. It's just the way the codes are shaped right now. It makes it harder for us. When the number one thing that comes up at any land use meeting I do, anytime we run a plat, it always comes up is these house lots are getting too small and too small and too small. And I'm like, there's nothing I can do about this. This is what the code is. And, if it says it had to be at 5,000, it had to be at 5,000. I mean, honestly, it doesn't matter if I grant 5,000 square foot lot or 7,500 square foot lot. Everybody says it's too small. And,
the lots in Clark County have historically gotten smaller and smaller, and affordability has gotten worse and worse and worse.
It all was set into place 1986, Growth Management Act.
So, you know, I think I love flexibility in codes, and I think this code can help with affordability, but it's not the be-all, end-all. It could actually have a backfire effect, because the more dense you get with a land, the more expensive the land actually gets. We know that R30 sells for more than R15. Okay, so I'm just going to use logical, you know, things here. Okay, and then there's the livability of the lots. Okay, you know, if you want right now, the way the code is shifting, if you want a 5,000 or 6,000 or 7,000 square foot lot in 5 years, I believe this code makes it virtually impossible to have. Which goes to your point, the livability of the neighborhood, where these kids are going to go, where they play, where's they're underdog, okay, they're running on asphalt and concrete. And so I very much feel that we have similar opinions. We probably get from stuff, but we're all people, so that's fine. It's part of being in America. So, it's a struggle, and the code's shifting there. And I think for the counselors, the aspect of right now we're going with a plan that's very much up and not out. And we've seen how that works in Portland, and it hasn't worked very well. And you get other things like gentrification. Okay, we get people in neighborhoods start getting demoed, because the only way we can get the density for the residents that we need is to demo them and go up. So it kills character by going up and down to on land and so on.
There's also the aspect that we're hearing under the population growth projections, which you mentioned, and that's we have a growing senior community and a lot of seniors that have been living in Vancouver and in Clark County. Unless they give their homes to their children, some of those homes are going to go on the market. So if you're projecting we're having more people dying than people who are being born, is that somewhat alleviating the problem of opening up these 1,200 to 1,400 square foot units? And then what you said is that you can't build a 1,200 square foot unit. It's really more cost effective to build a 1,600 square foot unit.
The cost separation is it's very slight. And then the appraisers typically appraise off of price per square foot. And so then the problem is your price per square foot skyrockets as you get smaller. And so then the difficulty is you can't appraise a home at a point that you can, it's sustainable as far as pencil. And so I can sell it at cost, but you can't make any money. So you could potentially do it in very limited settings, but it typically will not happen. And so you would have to have, by having a larger house, your price per square foot, typically look at things. It's a dynamic of a struggle that we deal with appraisers.
And it seems like that appraisers are driving the decision making.
It's banks that drive the appraisers, because they won't loan you money to build it, because they're not going to be able to sell for that.
It's so the developer and the end buyer, it's both. It's the front, it's the beginning and the end, that both are limited by the finance
because
aspect.
Because if we're looking at land and trying to conserve on our land use, then building smaller units for those people who like to live in a smaller unit and have to look at more landscaping, are we totally taking that out of the picture?
You can always do more. It's just saying you don't have to. So you have flexibility to build what you would like to build on.
But oftentimes builders do build to the minimum.
Well, I think they build to the market. Because the main thing you want to do, you want to build to what people want to live in. Unless they're required to not do that.
I don't think I've ever met maximum density in development that I've proposed.
I've never met maximum density in development, ever.
I never designed one to maximum.
I typically come up against the barrier of minimum density because of critical areas. Typically.
Yep.
And then it gets into, which I didn't want to get into in this group, but we see in the city, or not in the county as such, we have a lot of existing tree vegetation. So if we are
making the lot size smaller, making the homes bigger? Are we retaining any of our existing trees? Because, you know, we have climate issues. We're not going to address them as climate issues. That's another thing. So there's, I think there needs to be more people at the table to bring in some of these issues. So at least we can think about them before climate decisions.
I can see on one project, like we just did, I think we have 1,100 trees that we're planting. So I hear what you're saying. I also would say that with the properties we typically have to develop today, there's we deal with a lot of times those easier properties are gone, so let's say more level. So we deal with a lot of topography and critical areas. And the areas that you can develop within typically create, they require a lot of grading and walls, and so it makes it difficult for existing tree retention. But then with that, though, we also have a substantial amount of new plantings, which typically on the carbon side, you are going to get with an older existing tree, they're towards the tail end of their lifespan as far as helping them on their carbon impact. So with newer trees, we can increase that carbon benefit.
But we're relevant together. We're relevant together.
Just to respond to your question, though.
No, but we know that with climate and the impacts of heat, that new young trees take 3 years to grow, and then who's maintaining those trees? So to maintain some mature trees seems like a better path forward as we look at the overall landscape.
There's a 2-year maintenance requirement, so they do inspect them to make sure within 2 years that they are locked. And if they aren't, you have to replant them.
We usually like the street trees and stuff, we have a minimum caliper size, so they're not like we're planting saplings. Right. They're usually like a 2-inch caliper. So they're a number of years old.
Expensive. $200 a plant.
I just wanted to know on the chat, Susan Ellinger said, can you can let the members know that one code section is not listed on the DEED website. It is 40.220 urban residential zones.
Okay.
Did you adopt the minutes from last week and I missed it?
Yes.
We did.
Can I just get a clarification from DEEB members? So in my note-taking, we're looking, DEEB is going to be filing for a Type 4 in regards to the landscaping.
Mm-hmm. Shared outdoor recreational space.
I don't know what that process looks like.
We have to figure it out. So I'm going to need assistance on
we're
that.
We're all new to that.
Yep.
It will be just like the biennial code process, but it's just landscape versus rec space, so it will go through the same channels.
It's the highest public participation that the county has.
And notice, even though I don't know how they'll notice on something like that.
It doesn't need analysis and data.
I will reach out to contacts at community or in planning and get some information on how that can be started.
Great. Thank you.
Jose.
All right, well, with that, looks like we've run over on time a little bit, but if there's anyone online that would like to comment during this public comment session, feel free to speak up. And seeing none, we'll go ahead and adjourn our meeting. Next DEEB meeting is May 4th. Thank you.
Not officially part of the meeting, but
did you
see May 4th? When is it?
That's not 30 days.
We had to bump this meeting a week because of
break.
So when is our next one? Yeah, it is May 4th.
So you get 30 days because I said you get 30 days for
okay.
Okay, so okay. So we can at least discuss it again.
Yeah, we can discuss it again.
Yeah.
Okay. It's the hybrid has been a challenge in these meetings since we've started doing it. I wonder if we can encourage whoever is at least presenting, either on the staff side and our side, that we're here, if we can be. I mean, it's nice to have that flexibility, but man, every time we seem to have technical difficulties. And it changes the flow of the meeting and the effectiveness of it.
I feel like
so I try to be here. I'm going to have a few in a mile town.
I feel like we're missing. First and second class citizens, let me just have a meeting.
So I will just keep pressing you guys.